It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, most of the focus in the run-up to election in Wisconsin has been on the governor's race, but the state Senate might also be in play. We'll take a look at that campaign.
But first, we're hearing music from Rodrigo y Gabriela from an episode of Austin City Limits. The popular public television series celebrated 40 years of music this month.
Since Willie Nelson took the stage on its very first episode in October 1974, other legendary artists throughout the decades have captivated audiences in Texas and in living rooms across America.
What started out as a humble television series is now a multifaceted brand finding new ways to connect audiences with live music.
A new book chronicles the story of ACL. It's called Austin City Limits, A History, and author Tracy Laird joins us now to talk about it. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, give us the origin story. How did Austin City Limits get started?
Well, you know, in Texas, in Austin at the time, there was a hoppin' music scene that was dubbed progressive country. And though it had the word country in it, it covered a lot of different genres. And it was a wonderful time in Austin. And the station, KLRU, was fairly new and had just benefited from a lot of construction on the University of Texas campus, a lot of infusion of state money. So they were under some pressure to start some program production, which fit in with public broadcasting's desire to have programs produced from across the country. And this was kind of a no-brainer. This was a wonderful opportunity to showcase this local scene. There'd be what seemed like an endless pool of talent to fill the spots, and a relatively inexpensive undertaking. In terms of other types of television productions. So that's where it got started.
And Willie Nelson, as we mentioned, he was the first artist to start it off. He had a big performance in 2006. Can you talk about Willie Nelson and Austin City Limits?
Yeah, so it was a great kismet that the pilot episode was Willie. There's kind of a side story that there was another artist, B.W. Stevenson, who was big in the progressive country scene. He was, in fact, considered then the biggest star because he had this hit song, My Maria. And he had filmed the original pilot, which was scrapped because, poor communication, the audience didn't really turn out, and it looked a little skimpy. So they came back to try to do it again, and it was Willie Nelson. And the audience, if you've seen this episode, is jumping, they're right there with him. He does, he does gospel, he does country, he does a parody of Merle Haggard's Okie from Muskogee. They're just having a great time. And what no one could know then is that Willie Nelson would continue to play such an important part, not only in the show's history, but in the city of Austin. You fast forward, these 40 years, and I guess not quite 40. In 2006, Willie Nelson headlined the festival. And that wraps arms around a lot of history where the timing of Willie Nelson on the pilot, Willie Nelson was about the hippest thing there was in 1975, and appealing to people across a wide range of genres, getting a lot of critical attention. And so the coincidence of Austin City Limits and Willie Nelson being on there created a kind of aura, I think, around the show that the city and the show continued to build on over the years, a lot of changes. But Willie Nelson remained a constant. And still, at 82, Willie Nelson's still a pretty hip guy. When they started the festival, that was something that no one could have anticipated back then on that 1974 pilot hearing.
Now, a lot of TV shows have tried to capture the essence of live music with mixed success. What is it that Austin City Limits does that conveys to us that live show feel?
I think it's that their priority has always been, and throughout a lot of changes, on capturing energy and magic of a live performance between the audience and the performer. I think that comes back to that progressive country moment and, performances like Willie Nelson on the pilot, where the people involved in producing the show, they were doing what they were doing because they had wonderful experiences with live music and they wanted to capture it. So they stayed out of the way of the music. And I think that is really distinctive on television. Other attempts, I think, put the priority on television production values, which you know, tend to emphasize, you know, multiple takes and doing things over and over until you get them right. Well, that's one thing in a sitcom, the kind of polish that you're looking for. But in music, that sucks the life out of that energy between the performers and the audience. And so, you know, across the years, the production team, they never ask a performer to repeat a song because something went wrong. You know, performers sometimes will do it themselves because they're self-conscious about being on TV. But I think it's that singular priority that spreads all the way across the 40 years.
Well, let's give a listen to another I picked almost at random, actually, from the available online versions. A bit of the Decemberists on the show more recently with special guest Gillian Welch.
Okay.
So have we seen a lot of that kind of special guests and pairing artists together over the years on Austin City Limits?
Well, there have been. And I think where you think of it the most on Austin City Limits is a tradition that started, I want to say, season 5, where they had the songwriter special. And so they would gather, you know, a group of really fantastic songwriters. And that was so successful and so wonderful. It's something that they've continued to do. They've also done similar gatherings for, you know, tributes to special artists like Stevie Ray Vaughan. After his untimely death, there was a tribute show to him. There have been, you know, celebrations of Mexican-American music that got together great performers across a variety of traditions that in some way have to do with Mexican-American music. And, you know, most recently it's been that 40th anniversary special that got together a lot of different guests, a lot of powerful artists on the same stage, you know, Bonnie Raitt and who else? Gary Clark Jr. and, you know, Willie Nelson again, and Kenny Wayne Shepherd, and all kinds of wonderful people. So that's been a big thread.
Now, you mentioned at the outset it was what was called the progressive country genre. And in my head, I think of Austin City Limits as, you know, branching out, but in the neighborhood of country. I'm wrong, though. They cover a lot of genres. How do they go into different areas yet still make it fit?
You know, that's been a gradual process. And that word, I think in the intro, the word brand, kind of comes up in the history of Austin City Limits about the 25th anniversary when I think it conveys the idea of a complex unit of meaning that it's hard to put your finger on. And I think that, you know, Austin City Limits emerged, it evolved from progressive country to more mainstream country to more roots music. And now, like you say, you can't really put a finger on what it is in terms of genre. I think that's something that took time to develop. I think that back in the 70s, or back in the 80s and the 90s even, there was kind of a wisdom that things needed a clear sense of genre to succeed, because otherwise how would the audience know that was, you know, their kind of music? And I think in this 21st century, we've moved beyond that, and Austin City Limits represents something much broader, like, you know, originality and quality in music. And so, you know, you played Rodrigo y Gabriela. They can be on the show in the same season as Jack White and Mavis Staples, and it all makes sense. But it, you know, it's taken a long time to kind of build that sense of identity.
For you, what's the value in going and checking out an artist on a show like Austin City Limits as opposed to buying, depending on the year, an album, a CD, or a music download?
Well, it probably gets back to that energy between performers and audiences, because I think we're so inundated with music in our culture coming at us from all sides. It's easy to kind of tune out or to give something a few seconds to, you know, and if it doesn't grab your attention, to move on. And I think when you see a performer on Austin City Limits and, you know, the cameras give you time to really, you know, appreciate how that person is on with their band members, or how that person is with the audience. You know, there's the saying, oh, they linger long enough for you to learn the guitar chords. So you really get a feeling of an intimate look at an artist. And there have been times when There's been an artist like I'm thinking of Raphael Sadiq was an example of a show. I've heard his music and it sounded nice and I hadn't really stopped. And then I saw his episode, and it really grabbed my attention in a way that made me, when I went back to his recordings, you know, hear it in a new way, hear the energy and the freshness that I had first kind of captured there on Austin City Limits.
Tracy, before we let you go, I've got to ask, you've watched a lot of episodes. Favorite performance?
Oh, my go-to answer is Tom Waits from 1979. It's a classic episode, not only for the great performance, but also in the way that it connects to the current era of Austin City Limits, where, you know, you never know what to expect and anything goes, but you have this sense that it's going to be something high quality. It's also the first show that the longtime executive producer, Terry Lacona, it's the first show he booked. And I think it really was kind of prescient in the future directions decades down the road.
Well, Tracy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Tracy Laird. She's the author of Austin City Limits, A History. You can see Austin City Limits on Wisconsin Public Television, among other times, a Sunday night at 11. Check WPT.org to find out details. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, share your Halloween plans. You can tell us about your costume, your party plans, and the best and worst candy choices. You can get things started right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
First, the race for Wisconsin governor has topped headlines this election season, but Wisconsin Democrats are also vying for control of the state Senate, which they say is in play.
Although all 99 state assembly seats are up for election, by most counts, that chamber is likely to remain solidly in Republican control. There are 17 Senate seats up for election, and it looks like three of those seats will decide which party takes the chamber.
Analysts say the numbers favor Republicans, but that a Democratic majority is not out of the question. Here to talk about the Wisconsin Senate race is Patrick Marley. He's state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, first, let's hit the assembly side. Why is that not in play?
The assembly has 99 members in all right now. The Republicans control 60 of them. So Democrats would really have to have a very incredible night that even the most optimistic Democrat is not contending as possible. In 2011, Republicans controlled all of state government, and they drew new maps for the legislative districts, as all states do every decade. And as majorities tend to do, they drew maps that are in their favor, and in the assembly particularly, it is a very difficult chance for the Democrats to take control of that house in any environment.
Turning to the Senate side, is the same story true for at least most Senate districts, apart from the ones we're going to key in on here?
Yeah, they definitely improved the map for the Republicans in the Senate as well. In fact, you know, right now the Republicans control the Senate 17-15. Really, it's 18-15. There's just a vacancy right now of a very Republican seat. And with this election, a seat in Racine that was dramatically redrawn is really not being contested. It will go from Democratic to Republican. So the Democrats start out with another seat deficit heading into this election because of the way the map is drawn there.
So the math says they need three seats, and there are three seats where they have one thing in common: a Republican incumbent is not running again. So that means
right.
Those are maybe in play?
Yeah, there are three seats that have really been up for contention. You're right that the incumbent is not there in all of them, and that is what the focus is, especially on two of those three for this final days of the election.
Let's take those each in turn, and I've printed off a map from the Journal Sentinel that does a nice job illustrating where they are. Let's start in District 17 in southwestern Wisconsin. Dale Schultz, a Republican, regarded as moderate, at least on some issues, is not running again. So what's the story of that race?
So Dale Schultz has definitely been a thorn in the side at times of Republicans because he has bucked them on some key issues, such as the collective bargaining changes that they made a few years ago. He voted against that. He voted against regulations to streamline, environmental changes that would make it easier to put a mine up north for iron mining. He voted against that and scuttled that bill for a time. Later, they were able to pass it. He's leaving. State Representative Howard Markline is running. He's a Republican, considerably more conservative than Dale Schultz. And Pat Bomhack is sort of a newer comer to politics, originally was running for the Assembly, now running for the Senate. That, of all of the districts that are currently held by Republicans, by the numbers, favors Democrats. It's sort of their best opportunity. By a Republican analysis, that on a generic ballot is a 52% Democratic seat.
And when you say by the numbers, I mean, we're doing things like looking at votes in past elections. This is not, the state Senate level is not usually something we have really good polling on. Is that right?
Right. There's been no public polling that I know of in any of these races. So that's right. Both sides do an analysis where they take a district and they look at how did, you know, what happened in the Bush versus Kerry election, what happened in both of the Obama elections, what happened in the attorney general's races. And then after crunching a number of election cycles through that, they come up with sort of a generic number for that district that favors one party or the other. As I said, this is from a Republican analysis, and they say that that seat has a 52% Democratic advantage. Now, you know, the quality of a candidate depends on a lot of this, the mood of the electorate. There are a lot of factors. We're seeing a lot of spending in that race. Howard Markline is a very effective fundraiser. He's raised $450,000 in this election, which is a very large sum in a legislative race. That compares to $131,000 that Bomhack has raised. And, of course, there's third parties on both sides running ads for and against each of the candidates.
Is that a common theme in all three of the seats that we're talking about, that unusually large amounts of money are coming into them?
Well, spending goes up every cycle, it seems, and, you know, the money sort of gets targeted in particular races. So you see, you know, many races where there's no spending, and then the ones that are both sides agree are the ones where the action is. You see a lot of money flooding in there, both from, you know, the candidates do a good job of fundraising, and you see the outside groups coming in.
Well, let's go east a bit into the Fox Valley. A longtime institution, really, in the Senate, Michael Ellis, not running again. What is the story of the race to replace him?
So Ellis originally announced that he was going to run again. He's been in office since the 1970s. Penny Bernard Schaber, a member of the Assembly, was challenging him. Ellis later decided to not seek re-election after a video came out of him saying some things about forming an outside election group that would have been illegal, and he dropped out of the race. Roger Roth, a former member of the Assembly and the nephew of Congressman Toby Roth, got in the race. That looks to be a very close election on the money side. They're very similarly situated. Roth has the edge, having raised $360,000. Penny Bernard Schaber raised $295,000. Again, we're seeing advertising up there. I would say this, in combination with the Schultz seat, is really where the bulk of the spending and the focus has been. That seat is sort of the flip side of the Schultz seat in terms of its the advantage for which party. It's a 52% Republican seat versus the Schultz seat being a 52% Democratic seat.
And briefly, before we go to the news, the other one, Joe Lipum, not running. He had run for Congress, lost the primary. Is that seen as a realistic prospect for Democrats?
That is a seat that's even more Republican than the Ellis seat. It's about a 55% seat. The Democrats were very excited about the candidate they recruited there. Her name is Martha Laning, and they felt that she had been able to do a good job reaching out to Republicans, had a more moderate position than some other Democrats. But, you know, by the numbers, a very, very tough seat, and I think that is the Democrats are now conceding that is less likely that they can win that one.
We're talking about the state Senate race with Patrick Marley. He's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel state capitol reporter. The Assembly looks like it's going to remain solidly in Republican control, but Democrats have hopes if they can take especially the three seats that we're talking about, and we'll go into those in some more detail coming up. Democrats hope they have a chance to take over the Senate. We'll talk about what that would mean, what either Democratic control of the Senate would mean or continued Republican control after we go to the news.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you following the Senate race in your district, and do you feel like your district seat is in play? Do you have questions about the implications of a Democratic state Senate? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Patrick Marley, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel State Capitol reporter, talking about the state Senate race. The Assembly looks poised to remain solidly in Republican control, but Democrats may have a shot at a majority in the Senate.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you following a legislative race in your area, or does it seem like it's so one-sided it just doesn't matter? Are you worried about the way redistricting works in Wisconsin that it might make your vote not matter when it comes to legislative elections? Are you in one of the swing districts? How much advertising are you seeing for your local state Senate campaign? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Patrick, is the governor's race really kind of sucking the air out of even these key state Senate races?
Well, it always does. I mean, you know, in any election, the most important races are the ones that everybody focuses on, from the average voter to the media. And you'll hear people running for the Assembly always complain about they can't get their message out. They can't get voters to hear what they're saying. You're even seeing it in the race for Attorney General, a very important job. You know, 70% of voters said in the poll yesterday that Marquette released that they didn't have enough information to form an opinion favorably or unfavorably of either of the two candidates. So, yes, the governor's race absolutely dominates here, and the down-ballot races have the perennial challenge they do of getting voters to even know who they are.
And there's been some talk, mostly from political reform advocates, of changing the way redistricting works, but are they voices in the wilderness? Is anybody in the political world or the public, for that matter, paying attention?
Well, I mean, I think attempting to get redistricting reform done is very difficult. The Democrats are recently on board with this, or they say that they are, but you've got to remember that in the session before the new maps were drawn, the Democrats controlled the governor's office and both houses of the legislature. They had full opportunities to put in place whatever kind of redistricting reform they thought was a fairer way or a more democratic way to do it. They did nothing. They didn't do anything to address that issue in hoping that they would be in control of state government. But in 2010, they were wiped out of office. Republicans took total control, used the powers that they had to draw maps that were incredibly favorable to them. And now the Democrats say that they want to change the system.
But they had their shot, in a way.
That's what I'm saying. It's very difficult to do because, you know, lawmakers themselves are the ones who draw the lines in Wisconsin, and you have to get lawmakers to change that system if the system is going to change. And it's always difficult for anybody, no matter where they're, what their political beliefs are, to be willing to give up power.
Now, suppose Democrats do manage to take the state Senate. What does that mean for politics? It would be a break on the Governor Walker, if he's the governor, or a help for Governor Burke, if she is. But they wouldn't really be able to change anything that's been done in the last 2 years, would they?
No, they would not. I mean, you would essentially have gridlock. It would be similar to what we have right now at the national level, because you'd have one house in one hands and the other house in the other hands, because, as we said, the assembly is going to stay in Republican hands. So essentially, the state could probably pass a budget, but little else, unless they compromised or they found some common area to rally around. But on the big issues that we've been hearing about, you know, like the minimum wage or tax cuts, it would be very hard for them to see eye to eye on that or to reach some kind of half loaf on those issues. I think you'd have to settle down for a lot of nothing happening for 2 years.
We'll go now to a caller at 800-642-1234. Cindy joins us in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello, and I am very concerned about all this gerrymandering, and I think it's time for a grassroots movement by the citizens to get a constitutional amendment to make it so that gerrymandering or any of these lines cannot be drawn by anybody other than a nonpartisan, non-political group of people.
Cindy, thanks. We've heard from other guests pointing to examples of other states that have moved in that direction. Patrick, it does, as you said, seem like maybe a tall order here in Wisconsin, given that the parties aren't taking the lead. Neither of them is.
Yeah, I mean, to change the Constitution, it would be the same as passing a state law. You have to, it's the ultimately, voters decide whether to change the state constitution, but to get it on the ballot, you have to go through the legislature. So that would be sort of a difficult process, because you'd have to have lawmakers themselves willing to change the way that they do business.
Well, looking ahead again to another possible outcome, say the Republicans keep the Senate, the Assembly, and the governor's office, have we gotten a sense yet of what their legislative priorities might be in 2015?
Yeah, I think the governor has laid out what he wants to do pretty clearly. You know, he's talking about trying to do more tax cuts. He sees that as a way to spur the economy and to do other things to, as he puts it, get government out of the way of the business community. So easing some regulations. He's made a big priority in this election about doing drug tests for people who get public benefits. I think the governor's agenda will largely be embraced by the legislature if it's still held by Republicans. And so, as you have in most of the last few years, see him getting most of what he wants and really leading the agenda.
And one more possible outcome, Governor Mary Burke, Republicans in the Senate and the Assembly. Do you see any way that they would make, I mean, they have to make a budget, I guess. What kind of compromise horse trading would have to happen to get them to work together?
Yeah, the state budget is the one piece of legislation that everyone tends to agree that the legislature must pass each session. You know, if you have Republicans controlling both houses, they can agree on what they want that to look like. But the governor of the state of Wisconsin has perhaps the most powerful veto powers in the country, and can, you know, change numbers, lowering numbers in the budget, or rewriting wholesale sections of it by crossing out specific words. And so the governor really holds the upper hand in those kinds of budget negotiations. But there are certain things that Mary Burke would want to do that she would not be able to achieve, most likely. For instance, expanding Medicaid to get more people onto the program and accept a lot more federal money. Republicans are very opposed to that because of their opposition to Obamacare. And although she can change what's in the budget, she really can't, you know, add things to it that aren't there. And so I think she'd find much of her agenda blocked by the legislature in that situation.
In presidential election years, it seems like there are some significant coattails. President Obama seems to have had them both of his elections here in Wisconsin. Is there a coattail effect that we know of in state legislative races from a race for governor?
Well, I do, I guess I would say yes, you're not going to see it to the extent that you see at the presidential level, but sure, if the, you know, whichever party carries the day at the top of the ticket or carries the day in a particular district, that's going to serve the person running for the legislature from the same party very well. So, for instance, we talked about the seat that Dale Schultz is leaving, sort of a Democratic-leaning seat that is held by Republicans right now. And even if Mary Burke loses as the statewide election, she is likely to get the most votes in that Senate district. That would be a help to Pat Bomhack, the Democrat running in that seat.
And I know occasionally in some elections in Wisconsin, we've had split ticket voting, you know, somebody votes Republican for governor, Democrat for Senate, that kind of thing. Do we, and maybe this is drilling down deep here, but do we split tickets voting for a governor and a legislative candidate?
Well, there is a history of some ticket splitting in Wisconsin. There's also been a lot of coverage in our newspaper about the polarization of the state and how the polarization really follows geographic lines. So I think you're probably seeing less ticket splitting. But, you know, candidates and political advisors who run campaigns really tell you that at the legislative level, particularly at the assembly level, who the candidate is and how they can connect with people matters a lot in a way that perhaps it doesn't as you move up the ticket. Because if you're running for the assembly, you know, you're representing perhaps 55,000 people. You do have a chance to connect with a lot of voters on the doors, knocking on doors, in a way that a governor can't. And so you can meet voters and sort of persuade them that you're the type of person, even if they might not agree with your party affiliation, that they trust you. And that might persuade some voters to vote one way for governor and a different way for assembly or senate.
Well, Patrick, thanks for joining us on what must be a busy week in the run-up to Election Day.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley. He's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel State Capitol reporter talking about the race for control of Wisconsin's state senate. You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, you can share your Halloween plans. We want to know what your costume is going to be, your favorite and your least favorite candy, and what traditions you may have around the day of Halloween. You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we speak with MSNBC's Chris Matthews about partisan gridlock in the run-up to Tuesday's midterm elections.
First, Halloween is tomorrow, and we want to hear from you about your plans. What is your costume? Do you have annual Halloween traditions? And is there a party in the works? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Also, what is your favorite Halloween candy, or maybe the one that you don't like? You don't buy it and you don't give it out. Is there one thing you avoid giving to the trick-or-treaters, or maybe you buy a lot of it because you want it left over? And maybe one more thing that you want to do every year at Halloween. What's fun to you? What says Halloween? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
And we asked some of our fellow WPR staff. John Munson's not trying too hard. He says he's going with grumpy old radio announcer for his costume.
And that's also your costume.
That's pretty much mine. I sometimes put on a funny hat when I give out candy. My favorite costume from WPR staff, reporter Maureen McCollum, said, making Halloween costumes is one of my favorite annual challenges. This year, my husband and I are the robots from Mystery Science Theater 3000. So I guess she's Tom Servo, he's Crow T Robot. They've won a contest, and she
nice.
Says she wishes she could interview candidates with that giant Tom Servo sphere on her head. So that's a great question. Now, how about you? 800-642-1234 is the number.
And we'll take our first caller now. Bobby Joe is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Bobby Joe.
Hello. How are you guys?
Good, thanks. What are you going to be?
I'm going to be a Wookiee, a Chewbacca, and my
awesome.
Son is playing as a Stormtrooper.
Star Wars classic.
I like
Heck
it.
Yes.
Did you make
Thank
your
you.
Own Chewbacca costume?
I sure did. Well, I went and bought brown fuzzy leggings and a Chewbacca hat, but I bought a vest with a fuzzy hood on it to go with it. The most of it is from Disney Fall. So.
And Bobby Joe, I got to ask, can you give us some Wookiee language here?
I used to be able to do it, but I haven't watched Star Wars in a while, so let me give it a try. I can't really do it.
Your Wookiee's a little rusty.
Yeah, I'll have to practice it tonight before tomorrow. So.
Wow, well, thank you for trying. That was a fun radio moment of the day.
Yeah, thanks, Bobby Joe. We'll go next to Chris with us in Sparta. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, what's your Halloween deal?
Well, I'm from the Iowa area around Des Moines, and everybody around there has the kids come to the door for their candy, but unlike Wisconsin that I've noticed where you just throw candy at them, they have to tell us a joke or do a trick to earn it.
Wow, oh. I've never heard of that.
And this is an Iowa tradition, Chris?
As far as I can remember.
And do you get good jokes out of them? Does any kid relinquish the candy rather than tell a joke?
Oh, no. They always have a joke ready. And there was a few kids that came to my door here in Wisconsin last year, and they didn't know what I was doing, and their costumes really weren't that good, and they were a little older, so I made a kid stand there and dance a little jig while his friend sang la 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 to him about 10 seconds long, and I gave him each a big old candy bar.
Oh, that's great. Chris, thank you so much. We are taking your Halloween costumes, customs, and candy preferences at 800-642-1234. That reminds me, I had some older trick-or-treaters once do a little Gangnam-style dance. I didn't request anything special. I was giving them the candy either way.
I got to tell my kids that they've got it easy, that these Iowa kids really have to perform for their candy. Hope they appreciate that here. Let's go to Nick. Nick is with us next in Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What are you going to be for Halloween?
The Huntsman from Once Upon a Time.
The Huntsman from Once Upon a Time. Is that a movie or a book?
Neither. It's a TV show.
TV show. Okay.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. Does it involve a sword or leggings? Rob is pantomiming something.
An axe,
an
right?
An axe?
Well, actually, it doesn't involve a sword or an axe, but mostly a bow.
Oh, right. A huntsman.
There you go.
All right. Well, good luck. I hope you get a good haul of candy, Nick, and make sure you have a joke ready in case you go by Chris's place.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for that. And on to Cindy in Silver Lake. And you can join us now. Tell us what your costume's going to be, what your favorite Halloween tradition is. Is there a candy that when you were a kid, you always were like, oh, Swedish fish? That would be mine. I'm not a Swedish fish fan. 800-642-1234. And Cindy, hello.
Hi. We're going to start a new tradition. We just bought a house in Silver Lake, and I love Halloween. I love dressing up. I love watching Face Off on Sci-Fi, so I like doing the whole monster mask. So this year I'm going to be the haunted, like a headhunter, sorry. And what we're going to do with the house starting next year, because we just bought the house, is that we're going to have like a haunted house. So you have to go through one side of the house is going to be like an enchanted forest, and then the back is going to be something, and then on the side we're going to have a graveyard. And that's how you got to trick or treat. You got to go through our little haunted house. So we're going to start that next year.
Wow, you guys are really doing it up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like we do love Halloween. The kids love Halloween and everything. And it's like, and I've seen other houses in this area where they do turn it into little haunted houses and stuff. I mean, I trick or treated where people were giving out like warm apple cider to the parents and everything. Hmm. So Halloween to me is a lot of fun, you know, family oriented. And I mean, you see really cool costumes out there. People are really going out and everything. So
nice. Well, have a great time. It sounds like that yours is going to be a super fun house that all the kids are going to want to hit for sure. Thanks so much, Cindy.
And you can share. Are you going to go all out this Halloween with your costume or with your house or with the candy? 800-642-1234 is the number. If you caught a busy signal earlier, as some lines have opened up. Here's some more of what's going on with WPR people. Larry Mueller says he and his daughter are going out as Milwaukee Brewers players. Our own Chris Molina is going to get out the old Gumby costume. I guess his other costume didn't come together. And Connie Beam, she's going to be a purple Minion. It's quite a warm costume, she said. The stocking cap she uses is really hot.
It's supposed to be cold in
Madison.
Cold
on Halloween, yeah. So maybe we'll get to see some of those in the office tomorrow.
Nice.
Are you?
I don't know. I might trot out the old bacon and egg. My husband and I always go as bacon and egg. I'm egg. He's, you know, veggie bacon, we call him. But we'll see. He might get creative this year. I don't know. I may bring in my egg costume. And we're going to go next to Nancy, who's joining us in Marshfield. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
What are you going to be?
Yeah, I had share my story as I spoke to the phone. When we go reading, me and three little my husband, if he can make it home in time, we go to a neighbor who will give out lots of delicious candy to the kids and fun little prizes. But she always gives me a baked good, like cheesecake or brownies or pumpkin bars, and then a beer.
Wow, that sounds like a great house to go to.
Can we put her on hold and get the address so we can swing by? Cheesecake, that's great. And you can't give that, they don't let you give that to kids. And it's wasted on kids, let's be honest. But I like that idea of giving cheesecake and other treats to the adults.
Definitely. Well, that sounds like a great Halloween tradition, Nancy. Have fun. I guess it's tomorrow.
Tomorrow already,
is Halloween already.
So back to our callers at 800-642-1234 as you share your Halloween costume, your Halloween custom, and your favorite treats as well. We've got Tina on the line in La Crosse now. Tina, hi.
Hi. My kids have always been insane for Halloween, and my now 33-year-old was taking the kids out and was going as a devil. Painted himself from his belly button to his hairline in bright red tempera paint. It wouldn't stay on, so he rubbed himself in olive oil, drew the horns, put a tail. It was great, except it didn't shower off.
Oh, no.
He spent the next several days down from being brilliant red. And we had a house once that did want a joke or a story, and my darling little daughter, who was dressed as a Disney princess, and she looked at them with big eyes, and they're like, well, can you tell a joke? And she's like, no, but I can make my armpit fart.
Tried and true. And gets the job done.
Thanks to her older brother. Yeah, I got candy. That was thanks to that older brother, too. He still goes out in his 30s with his kids dressed up as Batman, and I think he has as much fun as they do.
Oh, what a great story.
And I just picture him showing up at work the next week still bright red from...
That is adventurous. That's commitment for sure. And let's see. I think we got time for another call. Jerry joins us next in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I'm just listening to you about Halloween parties and traditions, and we have a tradition. We go swing dancing every Halloween.
Ah.
It's a Knights of Columbus here off of 91st or 2nd Street right there, and there's costumes, there's contests, there's swing dancing, and there's no partners needed. You just come on down. You don't even have to get dressed up if you don't want to.
Well, that really sounds like fun, Jerry. I love that tradition. I love swing dancing, and I never do it anymore.
Well, I wonder, do the costumes ever get in the way, Jerry?
Oh, some do. There was a couple that dressed up as two peas in a pod, and you can imagine where the peas were in the pod.
That's some great photo ops there for sure.
All right, well, have a happy dancing, Jerry. That sounds like a lot of fun. A couple of my favorites still at WPR. Brianne Chasseau going as Carmen Sandiego. Christy Taylor is going to be the log lady from Twin Peaks. Good timing. They just announced that the show is coming back. And our own Galen Druk is trying to pull together, I don't know how this is going to work, a pumpkin spice latte costume. It sounds more conceptual. I'm not quite seeing it.
Whatever it is, I hope he wears it to work tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see if it works out. You can still share your Halloween costume and your plans over at the Central Time Facebook page. Love to see what you have in the works. As always, I always think maybe I'll come up with a costume and I got nothing.
You could wear your funny hat.
Yeah, I think the funny hat is I give out candy and that's going to be about it this year.
Well, coming up, has shared political power always looked like the political gridlock seen in Congress today? We'll talk to MSNBC's Chris Matthews about how to make political compromise. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We go to the news with piano and keyboard legend Herbie Hancock in his early work with the Miles Davis Quintet. He's going to join us on the show next Tuesday to talk about his career. Stick around, there's more to come today on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.